to talk about stuff I'm sure almost everybody here has heard at least a little bit about, which is Fibonacci anions. And in particular, what I want to do is try and find models that have them. And this turned out to be kind of a much trickier problem than you might think, because Nick complained when I said it's the simplest kind of non-abelian braiding. In my opinion, it's the simplest kind of non-abelian braiding you can have. But the other candidate for simple being, well, the icing type of braiding, which is comes up in people's IP superconductors and comes up in the Moore Reed state of the fractional quantum Hall effect. But this one, even though we'll just say it's just as simple, is not so easy to find. And so this is a transparency for the general public in case somebody stumbled in here, but I probably everyone here knows this. So non-abelian braiding means that the wave function changes depending on the order in which the particles are braided. And these are supposed to be particle world lines, so those are our five particles, and they're moving through time. Of course, we're going to be dealing with two-dimensional space, so this is projected down onto the plane. But you imagine these as lines in space-time, and we're going to try and find models whose particles have certain properties of these braids.
What's the paper?
I don't think this is a real experimental photograph, but what these guys do is actually, but they do experiments on braiding. So they have some clever magnet set up, and they actually take part, they have some kind of two-dimensional particles, and they have magnets, and actually they can braid the particles around each other. So that's why I looked in their papers for like a cool actual photograph, and you know, they just had data plots and boring stuff like this. But I found their version of the simulation. So it's real braiding. They're not not
really
going
to be involved.
Sorry?
Are the entities that they braid any of
us? No. They're just they can probably. Yeah, it's not nearly. They can probably put magnetic fluxes and make them feelings. I don't know. I forget. It's the Scaltorp. You can look up the guy's name to find out exactly what they do. So no, it's not that useful, but it's a nice picture. So I stole the picture. So what I'm going to describe today is two different quantum loop models that have Fibonacci anions, and so I'll go through a very brief review again, because most of you have seen this, of what they are, and then I'll again go through a brief review, because most of you have seen it, but maybe not in detail, so I'll spend a little more time explaining to you what quantum loop models, and I'll explain to you a big problem that is, well, it's certainly appreciated, but I really want to emphasize it today, that makes it hard to get these Fibonacci anions, and so I'll say what D equals the square root of 2 means, and I'll then explain the ways around this. So to acknowledge my collaborators, right, all of whom are here. So a lot of the technical stuff was in a paper I wrote with Nick Reed quite a while ago, and on a topic that seems to be completely different. It had to do with the spin quantum Hall effect and S matrices and the Potts models and all that stuff. But due to the unity of theoretical physics, it's actually exactly the same mathematics that we're using here. I wrote a paper with Eduardo a couple of years ago now, and then there's some new stuff, in particular Slava Krushko. I just saw Slava walk in too, so that we'll hopefully hear soon. So there's, I said it was going to be brief, there's the answer. That's what Fibonacci anions are. And so to remind you, since everyone's I'm sure at least heard this, so that's our symbol for Fibonacci anion. I'm not really going to do any field theory today, but I thought I'd remind you what these thing is. If you think of a field creating one of these things into its operator product, you have the sum of two terms. And in particular, one very interesting kind of conformal field theory that has all the right mathematical properties to describe this sort of braiding and fusing behavior that anions have is conformal field theory. And what this means is you basically, if you have a field here, a field there, and you glue the two fields together, well, then they behave as if they're schematically a sum of the both. There's lots of coefficients and all that I've omitted when you're doing the operator product. What this does is just tell you schematically what happens on the other side. And for here today, the way you should think about that, if you've got two Fibonacci anions, then it's a two-state quantum system. And one of those two states basically behaves as nothing, or just a nothing particle, the other So, again, so since I put Fibonacci in the title, I guess I have to show you where the Fibonacci numbers come. And that's if you just count the number of states, as you just keep fusing these particles together, this fusion is associative, so you can do it in any order you want, and then you just count the number of things on the other side. And if you look at how many states there are, those Fibonacci numbers. So the number that's key for today is the famous golden mean. Books have been written about this number. If you just want to count now how the number of states increases with the number of particles, when you have the Fibonacci numbers, this grows as the golden mean to the nth power. And so that's the quick Fibonacci review. There's a useful heuristic, though, so maybe let me emphasize this for a second. The way I think about this is the quantum dimension is the degeneracy of the particle. So what non-abelian statistics are, it says, well, when you braid two of these things around each other, they change states. Well, so you have to have a degeneracy. That's the way what happens when you do the braiding. It'll change to different states. And so I think it's a pretty good analogy. You can think of this as basically the number of one particle states, which we usually just call the degeneracy. Now, it's not an integer, but what it means is the precise statement we wrote here. It's growing as that. So every time you add a particle, you add about that amount to the number of states, or multiply by that number of states. That's a useful heuristic to keep in mind as we go through what we're doing here. And so there's a whole interesting technology to discuss this in infinitely more depth than I've just discussed here. There are these Morse-Seiberg axioms that came up from studying conformal field theory, and they turn out to basically have the same mathematical structure, require the same properties of the anions as you do fields. And you can look at John's lecture notes for excellent explanation of that. So now let's cut to now thinking about the models we want to do. So, all right. So I showed those pictures at the beginning, and I said, well, we squash this down onto the plane. I already did it because I had to fit this on the screen here. And so what you get when you squash your braiding in 2+1 dimensions down into 2, obviously you get overcrossings and undercrossings. So we'll call that a braid and an inverse braid, I guess. And within these rules that I mentioned, there's a bunch of them, and I'm not going to talk about them in detail, but one, just to give one example of the kind of rules, you have to ensure that whatever braiding you want to talk about for your particles, what they satisfy, well, they have to satisfy this equation, which in context I'll say a little bit more about later. It's called the Yang-Baxter equation. And you can just see this thing is just dragging this one underneath, so the lines never cross to get from there to there. So this obviously has to be true if you want these things to represent braids, because these two would just correspond to slightly different projections of the same braid. And so when you make your rules, you got to satisfy that. So here's one of the simplest ways, maybe the simplest, of getting making rules for your braids. So what we want to do, and I'll make this precise in the sense of a lattice model, but we want to evaluate a braid. So we've got a braid and we want to get a number out. And so one way you can do this is to say every time you have a braid, I'm going to resolve it in this way. And I'm going to resolve it in terms of having the two not cross that way and the two not cross this way. And those are the only two ways you can take this braid and split it into lines that don't cross. And so then I'll multiply by this number q, which in all the cases we care about is a root of unity, and in fact, in the Fibonacci case, it's e to the I pi over 5 in my conventions. Two things to take home from this. So notice I've replaced with a linear combination, and if you're thinking of these as basis elements for wave functions, as we will, that's okay, because this is quantum mechanics. And also, if you're just thinking I'm trying to turn some tangle of braids into a number, that's fine. It just says I evaluate what this thing is and what that one is, and add the two together. So it's all linear, it's all nice, everything works out. So anyway, this is the braid and the inverse braid. So first thing we have to check is that the braid times braid inverse gives you the identity, and you have to check that it satisfies that consistency condition I wrote down, the braid relations, and it's trivial to check a few lines, both of those work if I set this number D, I set this number D to be Q plus Q inverse, and then what D means, it's the weight of a closed loop. And so then now you can take any spaghetti you want, all those tangles, I resolve all the overcrossings and undercrossings by this splitting, and then I just count the number of loops and take D to the number of loops, and that's my answer. And since this involves a sum of different terms, I have to have a sum of a bunch of different terms. And this is what the Jones polynomial is, and it relies, if when you try and do all this much more carefully than I'm saying here, is that these things satisfy algebraic relations. And this is a very old algebraic relation. It goes back to the early 70s from the studying the Q-state Potts models, where temporally lead showed lots of important things, a few of which I'll mention later. And I don't know who coined the phrase d-isotopy, if that was Mike or if that predated him, if you coined d-isotopy. Okay, all right. So Mike coined the phrase d-isotopy, which means when you're evaluating this braid, you can stretch these things as much as you want, as long as you don't cut them, and every time you have a closed loop, you just give it a weight d. So that's kind of ancient history, but now the new history, ancient being 20 years ago. Now the new history is we want to use this to find models with Fibonacci anions, and the way we're going to do that is to construct a quantum loop model. And I'll explain to you precisely what a quantum loop model is in a second, but first let me tell you what the ingredients are. So you need a 2D classical loop model that has a critical point, and that's going to be a big issue, and I'll talk about that a lot in a minute. So then you use each configuration in your classical loop model as a basis element of your quantum Hilbert space. This is a strange idea to get used to. I've been working on this kind of things for a while now, and maybe I'm sort of used to it. I remember it was years before I could really get my thing around. I mean, classical physics and quantum physics are very different. And so in a quantum physics, we have a basis. So you can pick for your system what you want. In this case, you pick some lattice regularization of your loops. Got a bunch of loop configurations. You make up whatever rules you want. We're going to make up some interesting rules soon. And then each of those is a basis element. So your states can be any linear combination of all of those. And that's what I meant when I was drawing these pictures. I said, in quantum mechanics, we can have this linear combination of different states. And here, that's what I mean by that. So each loop configuration you can draw is a basis element. And then there's a trick that I won't tell you in detail, but there's a nice way to at least engineer a Hamiltonian. This isn't necessarily a realistic Hamiltonian, but it's a real Hamiltonian. And the key thing is your quantum ground state is the sum over loop configurations with the appropriate weighting. And what I mean by appropriate is, for example, it gives you the Jones polynomial, this d-isotopy or whatever thing you want.
Sorry, what do you mean quantum Hilbert space? Quantum Hilbert space.
But I guess I should say the Hilbert space for the quantum theory. Is that Hilbert space with the quantum theory. Quantum Hilbert.
Do we allow the loops to overlap?
So in this, we will. But in this, if you define it this way, no. Right? So because this says you take a configuration, I can always resolve any crossing in this way. But we will. And so in the simplest case, no. And the ideas that sort of went into this whole construction, well, obviously Roxanne Kivelson had an important bit. They were thinking about quantum dimers, not so much loops, but it's basically a very closely related situation, and Kataev and Friedman really, I think, are the people who explained this and wrote this down. So just an evocative picture. I don't know why I made them different colors. It just looked snazzier. But so there's an example of a particular configuration, a particular element of the Hilbert space. The ground state then would be the sum over all such configurations, all the loops you can draw with the weight d to the number of loops in that configuration. So again, that's what I mean by quantum mechanics. And so the central idea, where the Fibonacci anions or whatever kind of anions you might want to get out are going to come from this model is you'll make defects. So you cut one of these loops in two. Now, if you can engineer things, so again, find a Hamiltonian that does what you want it to do. If you can engineer things so that these defects are deconfined, these endpoints are deconfined, so there's no energy cost to making a very long string, Well, then when you braid this one around that one, this in a string, well, this cut string of loop has to go around all the other ones. But because we showed how to rearrange loops, and there's a lot more to do than I said, but what you can hope for and what you can show in reality is that when you braid these defects with each other, they satisfy the same rules, and so that's where the anions come from. So there's there's one long paper by all five of these people. I think all of them are here, right? But one long paper, and then there's lots of subsets of papers with various of these authors that explain this idea in detail too. So everything I just said has been explained in much, much more detail than I just said. So you can direct your questions to them. And just to note, in this case that we're describing here, a famous old result of Witten is this has something to do with Trent-Simons theory. And these are the Wilson loops, well, Wilson loops and Wilson lines in the Trent-Simons theory, if you want to do it that way. Okay, so now that's standard history. I hope I didn't bore the experts too much, and I also hope for the people who haven't done this before, I got my point across, so please ask if I was too vague or too quick. So now I want to say stuff that maybe, well, it's been said, but it needs to be, I think, said in a little more depth. So, the first statement is one probably you all know here, since topological is in the title of the conference, is that the model needs to be gapped for this to work, basically. But for this also to work, the less appreciated point is this classical loop model needs to have a critical point. So I said, you know, this was your starting point. You have a classical loop model and it has to have a critical point. And let me explain in a little more depth what that statement means. So let me define now a little more precisely what I mean by a classical loop model. So the kinds of loop models I'm going to discuss have a partition function of this form. So this is now, I'm talking about 2D classical physics. In fact, the remainder of the talk is basically a talk on 2D classical physics motivated by 2D quantum physics, but essentially everything I say, aside from some side comments, is really a statement about two-dimensional classical loop models. And so this is the partition function of what I'm calling a loop model. So anyway, it's just got two bits here. This piece is a top, so it's a sum over all configurations, so you define some rules. So the simplest rule is that loops never cross. And, so you sum over all configurations on some lattice. And you basically have two weights. One is this sort of simple one. It's a weight per unit length. L of script or calligraphic L is just the length of all the loops. But then this one is kind of where it gets particularly interesting. That's the topological weight. So what it says is that weight depends only on topological properties of the loop. So for example, diisotopy being the simplest non-trivial example of a topological property, you just weight each loop by some number d. So this is this model, the model in the case where you just have loops that are self-avoid and mutually avoid, goes way, way back in StatMech. It's called the ON loop model. It comes if you take a limit of a certain ON spin model, which explains the name. And so the weight here is, there's a weight configuration per loop, and it's some number n to the number of loops. So that's all there is to that. N is d, well, here, but, well, it'll get trickier. So let me show you what the long-known phase diagram for this model is in two dimensions. So you just plot out the phases. Okay, it did show up. Also, this is n, our parameter. That's the weight per loop. And this is, I guess that's the temperature. 1 over k is the temperature. And what you find, so let's first ignore what's going on over here. If n is less than 2, what you find is a phase where it's not a critical phase, where the loops are dilute. So what dominates that sum are loops that are just very spread out. Now what happens in here is what dominates the partition function is loops that are bunched up. In fact, they cover a set of measure 1 of the lattice. And so again, these are the configurations that dominate that sum there. Obviously, you sum over everything, but when you look in the long distance limit, you can ask, well, what configurations dominate? And that's called the dense phase. There's also another peculiar thing that I'm not going to deal with called the fully tacked where since you're at zero temperature, you require every site to be covered. But so what's interesting here, okay, so this, now is this dotted line here is critical. And what you find, I didn't draw the usual RG flow diagram, but if for the physicists here, what you have is a RG flow, the dense line here, this critical line here is stable. So even if you start here at long distance, it'll be effectively like you're like there. And likewise, if you start here, you'll end up there as you go to longer and longer distances. And then this is a critical line between the Duluth phase and the dense phase. And so the exact values depend on what lattice. I looked up the value for the honeycomb lattice, and that's the answer. You can work out using various duality things exact results for other lattices where this Duluth dense line happens. You can work out where the dense line is too. And so my comment that this that you end up here means, in physics language, this dense critical line is stable. All right, so that's ancient history in physics. What a point that people know, but maybe it isn't stressed enough, is so once you make n greater than 2, things change dramatically. And what happens is, if you remember what the n is just the weight per loop. So because now this factor gets bigger and bigger, it just wants to favor more and more loops. And what happens once n is large enough, it turns out the answer is 2, well, you favor making lots of short loops. That just is what wins out and dominates the partition function.
Is that q equals 1?
Is that q in the Potts language?
Q equals 4.
It's q equals 4. It's q equals 4.
Little q equals 1. Quantum group language is little q equals
1. Oh, little q or big q? Do you, Potts q or quantum group q?
Quantum group q.
That's q, yeah, q equals 1. Or minus 1, depending on your conventions. In Potts, Potts q, it's q equals 1. Yeah, but not me, because I'm a physicist, so I use Q. Now, the confusing part, well, as long as we're on Qs here, is because physicists tend to use small Q for Q state Potts, but a number of us have pioneered the innovation of capitalizing the Q state Potts model. So now, so the mathematicians won. They stole Q from us. It was small Q, but that stuck for quantum groups, and so now we're trying. Okay, but back to the physics. This phase, short loops, when there's no critical behavior. And so that's important because what we're trying to do is build a topological field theory. So I said these are results for classical models, but I'm doing this because I want to do quantum models, and I want a quantum model which is topological. And what that means is there's no energy cost. So what happens from here to here, what that roughly means at this critical point, well, energy and entropy are balancing out. So long loops can coexist happily with short loops. That's what in physics a critical point means. There's no length scale. And that's a very topological thing, right? That the properties are not determined by any set length scale. Here, they're set by a length scale, which is the lattice. I mean, you want to have as many loops as you want, and so it's only set by the scale of the lattice. They'll just curl up lots of little loops. And so this is not topological at all. And so if we were to try to build one of these models on this, you could do it, but it wouldn't be topological because you've already got the length scale in your classical model. So that ain't going to go away when you go to your quantum model. You have to start with something without a length scale or something very, at least very close to not having a length scale. And anyway, so that's a heuristic argument. So that's the important point. Large font is what I just said. At a critical point, you need loops of all sizes to contribute. Well, that's what happens at a critical point. You need this for a topological field theory. Otherwise, there's a length scale that's clearly not topological. And so if you want to build a quantum loop model from the classical O(n) loop model, you have to have n less than or equal to 2, which, yeah.
Well, so just to understand this point better about the underlying classical system should be critical to support.
Yeah, or at least near a critical point.
Yeah. Topological place. So the Torr code, you can think of the underlying statistics of the states as critical percolation.
That's right.
But you could also think of it
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, so, right, so I certainly spent a lot of time thinking about that case. And so the way I think about that in this language is there's a nice phase diagram in a paper I wrote with Eduardo, which I almost put in the talk, but I decided that was abelian, so hence not allowed. But
well, you could ask the same thing for Fibonacci.
Yeah, well, you could ask the same thing there. But the point is for even though, you know, in the Torah code, it's not critical, except in this loopy sense, there is a proximate critical point in say, the eight-vertex model language. So one way of writing the Torah code is an eight-vertex model, and there's a critical line in that model. So we're not, that's why I amended this statement slightly, so you have to be near a critical point. So what I would
say... Which one, considering is critical percolation?
What? Well, I'd say that's fine, too. I mean, I can... So I'm saying in either language, there's a critical point nearby. So if you want to just think about critical percolation, which is probably the most accurate one, because that's the actual criticality of the loops themselves,
Yes. That's
the best way. I'm just saying, even if you want to think about it, you asked about the high temperature phase of the icing model. It isn't the high temperature phase, but there's
well,
a nearby
what, critical point. Well, what's confusing to me is that the same configurations can be characterized either as a high temperature phase or as a critical phase, depending on what underlying model you take.
Let me comment. The issue is that what is, in a sense, when you think of this called high temperature phase,
you're
trying to parameterize it in terms of the diagrams of the low temperature phase, which have already proliferated in that phase and have no space at all. So when you go deep in that phase, you're not using the natural variables of the ice and more than the high temperature phase, which are the creating space, you're using domain rules, which are already proliferated. And those things in that sense are still critical.
I would say as a moral point, though, you need critical points around. I think that's not a precise thing. I should also say that
this is
not in the paper Eduardo and I wrote, it's what Eddie Mardon and Eduardo and I wrote. But anyway, yeah. So but in this case, so if you want a precise definition, say that in terms of the loopy variables that you're interested in, you need to have a proximate critical point. So that's a more precise version.
Isn't the precise statement that the loops themselves should be critical objects and they don't have to be expressed in terms of local quantities and whatever stuff?
That's right.
So
model
itself can be far away from criticality.
But I would say it still needs a proximate critical point. I don't know proof of that statement. But I would say even if you're going to write this in terms of spinny variables, if you don't have a critical point somewhere, you're not going to be able to. But that's
domain walls and even temperature easing model are going to do it, but the even temperature easing model is infinitely far away from criticality.
No, it's not. I mean, it's still in the scaling region. I mean, I'd say that's not true. Okay, so it sounds good because I said n is the weight per loop, and n needs to be less than 2 to be critical. And we want each weight, when you worked out the details, to show that it satisfies all the Breger relations. This parameter d, the weight per loop, has to be q plus q inverse, and q is a root of unity. So d is less than 2, super. Looks like we're all critical. But what Mike observed in his paper on this, I guess 5 years back, this is quantum mechanics we're doing here. So I said again, it was a statement about classical loop models, but we want to do quantum mechanics. And in any correlation function, each configuration is weighted by the probability amplitude squared, just the way it is. And so when you're computing, say, a correlation function or a thermodynamic quantity or whatever you want to compute in your quantum loop model, each configuration has squared weight. And so thus, why I wrote n and d separately is because when you're doing the thermodynamics, for the phase diagram, say, that I draw down, the parameter n has to be d squared. So it's just staying, each configuration member is d to the number of loops, but I have to weight it by its square. So the weight per loop is now d squared. And thus, for this to work, d has to be less than or equal to the square root of 2. So that n can be less than or equal to 2. Otherwise, you just land up out in over here. So that's the problem I alluded to at the beginning. For Fibonacci anions, d is related, is the 2 cosine pi over 5, which is 1.618 dot dot dot, and that's of course greater than the square root of 2. So we want to find a loop model that has critical behavior. So here's how we're going to do it. I said there's two ways, but both involve very different versions of this, but they both come from the same starting point, which is instead.
A dumb question that people aren't.
It's not a dumb question.
One, I haven't heard yet. Yeah. For those people who aren't that well versed in this, so just between the connection between the 2D model and the quantum mechanical model, can you make a little bit more clear with the why the criticality in two dimensions shows up? I mean, it seems like it's a slightly different construction here.
It is slightly different. I would say if it's not critical in two dimensions, so the key thing is, so the point is in these Roxar-Kivelson type things, the ground state wave function is of this form, where it's this sum over all loopy configurations, and then there's a topological weight here. So this is the simplest kind of topological weight, due to the number of loops. When we have crossing, it's going to have to be more complicated topological weights, but it's still a topological weight. If this thing has a length scale already built into it, it's hard to see how you're ever going to get anything out of it. I mean, it's a necessary but not sufficient.
The statement that the classical partition function doesn't have.
Then the correlators reduce to those in the 2D system, and at least those are good. Now, you can presumably, if you take arbitrary Hamiltonians, you can introduce a length scale that way, so that's why I said it's necessary, not sufficient. But if it's already there, then you're doomed from get-go.
You could have a length scale, but if you then provide that you're in the basin of the fraction of the fixed point in the vanishing correlation, then that length scale as a curve scale will go away.
Of course. But you need to be in the base.
Some crystalline, order pattern of or something.
That's right.
Like that, then you will never access it because you need to go to the phase transition.
So that's why I fuzz all these statements by proximate. They're actually much more refined ways of making these statements. But I think that for many purposes, the fuzzy statement is more useful. Okay. So we're allowing. Crossing. So again, remember, we start with some braiding of our whatever anions we want to look at, and we squash that down to the plane, so we get overcrossings and undercrossings, and our loops came from this prescription of how we change the undercrossing and overcrossing, the braid and braid inverse, into stuff that's nice and planar. And so we're going to allow crossings, and it turns out there's a way of doing this that satisfies all the braid conditions that we need, and it arises again algebraically, just like the Temporal-Lebesgue algebra. And I'm not sure what order I should put them in, but at least Nick and I couldn't resist putting them in the BMW order. So it was a paper by Berman and Wenzel, and another one by Murakami. So I've seen NBW, BWM, and so we compromised with BMW.
People were hoping we'd get a call out.
Yeah, right. If anyone knows it, BMW. Anyway, so it's the same idea, but now it says every time you see this braid, you add this particular linear combination, we're going to Q as a number that's going to be a root of unity in the interesting cases. And but now we allow that bit too. This is a permutation? Which one? What's a permutation? It's just a crossing.
It's a
crossing. Sorry.
What do you mean?
It's a crossing.
What rules does it behave?
I haven't. We're that's next. Next. I haven't told you what rules it says. Right. So you start out with this, and then we have rules that I'm going to tell you about. Okay. Well, first I'll tell you why I'm telling you about these rules. So for the BMW algebra, you can find for any of the B, C, D. Simple Lie algebras. The two cases I'll focus on are the two simplest, which is SO3 and SO4. And but one of these, the SO4 case, allows you to, in essence, modify those models slightly so that you can square the loops and get critical behavior. So let me. Okay, good. Okay, so I'm going to now explain the rules. You can write them out in all generality, and there's been 15 papers that done, and it's all horrible and ugly, and you don't get any intuition. So I decided to do it the physicist style, and I would just do the two simple examples I care about. So here's the rules. So SO4 has this great property, which is just not exploited enough, but it's the fact that as a Lie algebra, SO4 decomposes into two copies of SU2, and this also stays true in the quantum group deformations. And so in particular, in our language, these lines, so notice I'm using the red lines now for here, so I can take any one of these lines here and decompose it into two identical lines. I just made one dotted just to they're distinguishable, but they're identical. So I just made one dotted so you wouldn't be tempted to glue a dashed line, so you wouldn't be tempted to glue a dash to a solid. They're completely separate copies. So I just labeled them that way. And when you work out what these relations are, okay, so if you've got this thing, if you've got a closed loop like before, well, this just turns into two closed loops of my two things, and so that gets away d squared. And this crossing now is not a permutation or something so simple, but what it is basically take the two copies and do the two ways they kind of cross each other. I'm not sure how to say it, but the picture is much easier. It just says this one hits that one. So that's like our non-crossing for copy one and non-crossing for copy two, and then vice versa. And it's the sum of that.
That's a way to sum them up.
Well, I mean, it's symmetric in the two. So that's why it's the sum and not the difference. I mean, you could, depending on how you define these things, of course, you could put a coefficient there. But you want it to be symmetric in the two copies. Again, because these are literally just two copies of the same thing. So there's no...
Just notationally, that vertex is invariant in the rotation.
And also, that's invariant in the rotation. That's another risk.
And why don't you allow for this time, for example, to cross like the other?
Yeah, that can happen, and then we would just write it as the other one. But I'm saying if you take once I make this definition of the braid generator, so if you wish, now what you just said is this term there. So it's just, I mean, I could obviously lump that into that and redefine things. This just happens, this is just one choice of the way I make my rules. You can reshuffle things, of course, if you want, but only reshuffle. You can't change anything, but you can reshuffle. But the way I define these things is that I could have included that. No, I just drew it that way because it looks prettier. But
but sometimes you drew it one way and sometimes the other. I mean,
oh, did I mess up?
But so I just kind of understand. What was the reason again that they're not both rendered the same way?
Because I can't glue a dashed line to a solid line.
Why would you be tempted to do that?
Well, if I were drawing pictures and using solid lines for them both, you could confuse. So I can distinguish the two lines. I just dashed one and another. Well, so if I'm doing this algebraically, right, I'll then, you know, the BMW relations, then, you know, you put this on this just like I drew for the Temporally-Lieb relations, and so you have to be careful. And so, yeah, if you always put one to the left and right, but then the problem is then you would have, I would draw that loop like this, I guess, which you could do. But then you start to see all these crossings. So it's just, this is the simplest way I could pictorially do it. So it's just two copies, and they can, when they cross each other, it makes no difference. But there's no meaning to the dotted crossing the solid. So that's what I tried. So the key thing to notice now, we've split solid lines and the dark red lines into two lines, and so the dash can always cross the solid ones at will. It doesn't matter. But they never cross each other. So if you look at what we do here, the dash lines never cross, and the solid lines never cross.
Would it be a good way of thinking about it? You could have the dash lines on a slightly higher plane.
You could do that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. You could have two. So when we get to squaring the wave function, that's in fact the way you should think about it. Right. You have two planes, and they have to mesh on top of each other, but they're separate. That's why we're going to get to square the question.
Yeah, two times slightly.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, so we get a loop model down, so I can just, instead of defining the loop model with the way before, I have another loop model. And so the rule is, well, these two lines are always together, but at vertices, they can join in different ways. And you just sum over all configurations. And then there's a more general topological weight, which I didn't write down, but the key bit in the topological weight that we care about is, again, you can just make it so that closed loops of each have a weight D. And you can check that that's consistent with all of the BMW relations. So each closed loop of the each individual kind gets a weight D. So that's why I wrote up here that if you have this, that gets weight D squared. But now once you allow them to intersect and all that, it gets more intricate. So why I brought all this stuff up is because these double loop models have critical points for all D less than 2, not square root. And so I wrote a paper last year showing how you take a certain limit of some interesting lattice models called fused RSOS models. And you can see that if you make some technical assumptions about the continuum behavior, you get those loops. And those assumptions you can check. You can't prove. Well, at least I couldn't prove, but you can check in various ways. And you get a particular critical.
It's not important to start with SO4. You could start with any double theory.
Well, that's an interesting question. So you could certainly do that. And if, for example, you can change the weighting on the loops. Now, then the question is, will you get a critical theory? And I would guess yes, but it's never been shown. But I would guess you could do that. In fact, there exist things called dilute. Well, in fact, wait. So people then show... People showed that you could construct various lattice models that satisfied all the appropriate grading and so forth relations and have all the properties one would expect with the right algebraic structure, but no one's then shown that they're critical. But if anyone wants me to explain how to do corner transfer matrix computations and do that computation, I would be happy to. It's a dual computation. So anyway, so there's a sort of direct way where you start with a model that's defined like this on the lattice, and then that's the computations that haven't been done yet in depth, although I did it for this one. And so it's natural to expect, that's not a proof, but I have two kinds of critical points when you do this, and so it's natural to expect that you get the same kind of phase diagram. But that's, again, not yet proven, but for our purposes today, I just said I want a critical point, and it's definitely a critical point. I should mention that lots of people in the 80s and early 90s worked up these lattice model properties that I use. So why I did this was so I could square the models I told you about to begin with. So I said, well, there's the problem with restricted solid on solid. So these are also height models, or Andrews, Baxter, Forrester. They're referred to in the literature in many ways, but that's, I can.
You're cycling through a lot of pseudonyms I don't understand.
Well, these are particular integrable lattice models that people, with a variety of motivations, studied a lot of, particularly in the 80s. But the key point is they're solvable, and you can do exact computation, so you can show that they're critical. More about those models if you want. So now what I want to do is find out how to square that original model. So if you remember, we had these loops, and the problem is when we gave them weight d squared, we got over this barrier at square root of 2. But so now, okay, so now consider a lattice model where you allow crossing. So the picture I did before. But if I see a crossing and I say, well, I'm gonna give it the weight as if I resolved it in this sum. Okay, so that's certainly a rule. But it's not the same model as if I didn't allow this to begin with, because this is an extra kind of configuration. So if you wish, it's changed the entropy once I allow this. So I haven't changed the allowed configurations, but what I have changed is the weight per configuration, because now I have this as an allowed configuration. Now I end up turning it into that, but it's a different weighting. And so if, again, I resort to this solid and dash, so if I have this one and then the squared one, it's just the same thing again. Well, if I just multiply all four out, I get all the two things out, I get four terms. and you just get that. And everything there is in my, is in this thing here. I mean, the other two terms are there, and then these funny cross terms are there.
Sorry, if you resolve the, if you use that rule in the middle, in the previous transparency, then it just seems to change the coefficients of the original Kaufman resolution.
Yeah, but the difference now is when we square it. So if I write this now, remember, I consider this as a given configuration. So when I square, right, I get this. And so what's new is the cross terms. It's this one and that one. Okay, so the squared model is not a simple loop gas of self-avoiding loops. It's this funny one that I drew before. So even though the original one is basically is just the same loop gas you considered with some modified weights, but topologically the same. The squared one is it, because it's got these things which didn't appear in the original. Okay.
Can you think of this as taking some kind of a tensor product and then a quotient? Or?
Probably, but that sounds right. Other than saying, yes, that's the right idea. It sounds like the right idea. I don't.
Probably just a tensor product.
No, because... Oh, tensor. Oh, yeah, tensor product. Yeah, sorry, I was thinking it's some direct product and then the quotient, but yeah. Okay. Well, something like that.
Oh, sorry, I mean, for your last slide. So, can you explain somehow again about this proposal?
So, when I have this, so I have a different I start out with a different loop model than I started out with. I allow loops to cross. But when I evaluate each configuration, and if I'm doing just looking at the wave function itself, not the wave function squared, I just any time I see a crossing, I replace it.
In this case, you don't have undercrossing and overcrossing.
No, because we've already done. We've used where is it? That one to get rid of the undercrossing and overcrossing. But now I have this new one. Now it says, well, when you have that, replace it as a sum of that. But that changes the weighting within the loop model. The topological weight has changed. Of this. So that's why it's a closely related model to the original model, but it's
so
not the same.
Actually, your diagrammatical representation is just for Bernoulli's algebra.
That's right. That's right. And one particular way of writing a Bernoulli Murakami algebra. And so what I've been saying is that one would think, although this is not proved, that all we've done is basically change the regularization. It's the same set of configurations but with different weightings. So you would expect that you get the same topological behavior. And in particular, you get Fibonacci anions when this parameter k is 3, it's SU2 level 3 in the Chern sinus. Okay, good. So we have about 5 minutes? Yeah. So that was how to square the original ones. You modify the short distance behavior a little, and then if you choose things right, you get these critical points in there. Hopefully work out like you want it to do. So there's a second way, which actually is in a paper that came earlier that I wrote with Eduardo. And so now I'm taking the same BMW algebra, but now I colored it green to distinguish it from everything else. And it's a different, it's another BMW algebra, but it's the SO3 BMW algebra. So again, I was asked what the relations were. So these are the relations that are the SO3 BMW algebra. There's a third one that's too ugly to write out, so I didn't. But there's that involves three strands instead of two. But the two strand relations all look like this. So again, you've got when you have a closed loop, you just get some number. I'm not calling it D. I'll call it Q minus 1. And if you do this kind of ribbon here, I don't know if it's their name. When you do that, you can just remove that extra loop, again, with the factor Q minus 1. So this is essentially, it's a very similar rule to that. Now it says if you have this kind of crossing, well, you add Q minus 2 times just the ordinary crossing plus that. And like I said, the three-strand one is ugly, but you can write it out. So that's the algebra. To get Fibonacci anions, you have to take Q to be tau plus 1 so that those close loops. Again, since this is Q minus 1, so you get tau for a single closed loop. And so it's a perfectly well-defined model. And again, the problem is, can you square? When you square it, do you get anything that has a critical point? And so Eduardo and I had, actually, I think in retrospect, of course, brilliant arguments to conjecture this, and it turned out that our brilliant conjecture was proven 36 years before we made it, so that shows how smart we were, I think. And anyway, so this was pointed out in a paper by the Microsoft crowd last year. So let me explain that a little, so to finish, so why we thought these things. So they have something to do with the Potts model and chromatic polynomials. So let me first explain what the chromatic polynomials, and then I'll explain why those relations have something to do with the chromatic polynomial. So the chromatic polynomial is related to this famous coloring problem. So you've got a map of the U.S. and you ask how many different ways that are, say, coloring a map of the U.S. So each state is colored a different color when they border on each other. So how many? They'll depend on how many colors you have. So say we have three colors here, and we look at configurations like this. Well, this is one kind of coloring of this thing, and the coloring polynomial is just a polynomial in the number of colors you have that tells you the number of ways you can do that. And there's a very simple way that I won't bore you with, but to define this for any Q, not just Q integer, and you just define it through a set of recursion relations. And so that's called the chromatic polynomial. There's this famous four-color null theorem, which proves that any planar map you can color with four colors. So one thing to note, I drew this picture deliberately. So notice if two regions, so two states, so Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado, only meet at a point, Colorado is not adjacent to Arizona, and Utah is not adjacent to New Mexico by this. What? All right, so this can be instructive in many ways.
So there's Utah.
There's Colorado.
There's Arizona. And
there's New Mexico. So they all meet at a point. To maximum, so you got eight senators to. Well, they should have done that.
Also, there's nothing else there.
There we are. So that's right. So Utah and New Mexico do not border on each other. So look at these relations now. Okay. Well, so what this? So why chose? Well, this you could color. So this is some fixed color, let's say, runs through. So we just fix the color on the outside here. Well, if this has Q separate colors, but then once that color is fixed, then there'll be Q minus 1 colors allowed on this. I call that red. And I could just do the remainder except for red there. This is the same deal here because this color and that are the same by the way I've drawn this. So again, this can be any color other than the one that's out here. Now this one is a little bit tricky. You have to think for a second. Well. This one and that one don't have to be the same color. Now, if they are, that's fine. But if they're not the same color, if you don't know what they are, well, then you can sum over these and make sure that you get Q minus 2, because say that one's red and that one's blue, and there's Q minus 2 others. But say they are the same, they're both red, well, then you can just get one more, then that one could be blue. So those are the same relations. You can check this three-strand one that I didn't draw also satisfies that property. So what turns out you can check, and this, I don't know, Slava's been looking through the math literature, and this seemed to be one of those sort of known facts that if you follow a trail of equivalences, it's correct, but no one, I mean, including, I guess, Nick and I, who derived this our own way, never said outright the chromatic polynomial is generated by the BMW algebra, even though it follows directly from what Nick and I did, and it follows directly from what.
I mean, we all know that you get the chromatic polynomial as some limit of the Potts
That's right. Well, that's why, in a way, it sort of instantly it instantly follows from our paper. I don't think we uttered those words, but it follows from a lot of statements people have made, but I don't know of anyone who actually said it. But okay. Yeah. Right. That's the regime. So that's why. So
the Yamada polynomial is just the quantum Lincoln variant from SU2 using the Adler representation instead of using the three dimensional representation to the Wilson loop.
Right. Well. So that's next slide here. There we go. So the way to think about this is. Or a useful way to think about this is now I can split this into this. And so what, again, if you think, well, there's two cases. Either this one and that one could be different, and so I can draw it this way, if you're thinking chromatic polynomial, or this one are the same, and I can draw it that way. So if these things are satisfying the chromatic polynomial, I can break into trivalent vertices. And what Greg just said was that, well, it has to do with the spin 1 representation. And if you think if that's a spin 1 particle and that's spin 1 particle and that's a 3, 1 times 1 gives you 1 plus 0 plus 2. And so that's just the trivalent vertex there. And so so you can make a loop model now that has trivalent vertices. And that's what Eduardo and I discussed. And then this makes contact with what I guess Greg's talking about tomorrow, and what I forget if Mike's talking about that too, but what a lot of people have talked about recently gives you an example of what's been named string net theories. Out of time, so let me just say, let me just say something about the proof. So again, it was proven 36 years ago, but what Tutte proved 36 years ago was a marvelous identity for chromatic polynomials, and he proved that you square a chromatic polynomial for any planar graph, but at the special value of Q that we want for Fibonacci anion. So this is a theorem that applies only to one value of Q for the chromatic polynomial, but for any planar graph you draw. And there's a relation between the square of this chromatic polynomial and then the chromatic polynomial at a different value of Q. So this is tau is 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, so that's 3 plus the square root of 5 over 2, that's 5 plus the square root of 5 over 2. But then if you make the observation, the physics is that the chromatic polynomials come up from the low temperature expansion of the Potts model, like Nick said, is then if you take this Potts model and square them, you get a Potts model at a different value unsquared. But in Potts models are critical when Q is less than 4, capital Q. And so this model is critical. And in fact, this normalization here looks kind of ugly, but Fikowski and Mike and the Microsoft people showed that, in fact, when you set everything up properly, that's the nicest normalization. It cancels other stuff perfectly. So, good. So, this. So anyway, you can construct the topological field theories there. We haven't shown that you can square this for k greater than 3, although I kind of know how one would do it, so I think it should all work, but I haven't shown it yet. And you can construct the Jones-Wenzel projector by using, again, this idea that they're spin 1, and so you take 2 spin a halves and get spin 1. Okay, so since I'm out of time, just put on the transparencies. The experts read the technical comment and talk to me about it later. Here's the big question. I mentioned this Roxhart-Kibbleson-Hamiltonian lets you engineer the physics you want. That's a great thing. I mean, it gives us some confidence we know what we're doing, but they're real. To me, the real essential theoretical question in this is, can we now come up with simpler Hamiltonians that have the same physics? And that's, a question on which some progress has been made, but we need lots more progress. Okay. Thanks a lot.